Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Marvin Garin, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Hey, Paula.
Hey, buddy.
My pals, yeah. My comrades in arms.
Yeah. The whole gang.
Yeah.
The whole gang is here. Which next week we'll all be gone. We'll all be at the Fellowship Summer Study Session in Illinois, in the Chicago area. I think that's true, Marvin. Is that true for you? I know Chuck and Andre
yep.
will be there.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. We'll all be there.
Yep. Yeah, we'll all be there.
So
yeah,
that'll be fun. Should
yeah.
be a great conference because we're celebrating Machaventa Melchizedek. What could be better than that? One of the heroes of Urantia.
Well,
indeed,
yeah.
1,001 years.
Yep, 1,001.
Yeah. Emergency revelation. And you know, it's interesting. I mean, here we are. We're still dealing with one emergency and another. I mean, witness the fact that we haven't gathered as in the summer, typical summer study session or conference. What is it? Is this the third year that finally we're meeting after a two, three-year hiatus
well,
from the whole
yeah,
COVID?
Yeah, it's been
yeah.
a two-year hiatus, yeah.
2019
was
the last one.
It's three now. Yeah.
Yeah. And 2020 was an international conference, and I don't think we've ever missed one of those, at least since we started doing them.
Mm-hmm.
So
that was a big disappointment because we didn't get to see
yeah.
our buddy Gary Tong. We were going to be stone's throw from him. And that would have been fun being in British Columbia, my old stomping grounds, for a little while in my youth. But it was not
so
to be
beautiful
2020.
There.
What we were looking for that 2020 vision turned out to blindside us after all. So away
and
went
it ended
the
up in the rear view mirror.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. Keep them coming. Keep them coming.
It was, you know, I was disappointed because I was so looking forward. That would have been my last international conference as director. So it would have been the last one that I, you know, worked in terms of registration and all of that, and running a store. And but I was really looking forward to Gary and Kelly Kavanagh's work together on his amazing music, and Gary put it all to incredible, amazing graphics. And they were going to debut it at the conference, and the story goes that while they were testing it, that the venue had a state-of-the-art auditorium with integrated sound and screen, and everything was just, you know, high-end technology, and they were playing some of the pieces that they had worked on together, and the tech guy at the conference went, "Wow, this is fantastic." He couldn't get over it. He was just blown away. And I thought, oh, that's going to be so great to see that. I couldn't wait to see that. So that was the big disappointment for me, that didn't get to happen, you know.
Well, it's just so characteristic, you know, of this, of the the way of things on this world. And, you know, this this celebration of the emergency revelation of Melchizedek, you know, we've been reading recently about the Melchizedek sons, you know, and they that's what they do. They come down and they serve in all kinds of things that are unexpected. And the unexpected and Urantia are almost synonymous, I think, in universe affairs. Exigencies, unexpected things and surprises and emergency missions. And, you know, I mean, this amazing Urantia revelation we have is another example, case in point, you know. We're constantly adapting to unforeseen circumstances. It's not a normal place we live in.
I think we were commenting last week about, or last time, about what a big hand the Melchizedeks have in the Urantia book itself. You know, just how many papers are written by Melchizedeks, and some of them are named, which is interesting, and then others are not. But there's even one. There's one paper that was co-written by Macaventa and a mighty messenger, which, if you know which one that is, it's paper 56, Universal Unity. And that's intense. I mean, the philosophy in that paper, you know, it's like, it's one of those papers, you know what I mean? Sometimes people sort of glaze over.
So we may have to do it soon.
Yeah, no, I really think we should. Yeah. But it includes the section about truth, beauty, and goodness, which is the final section of that paper, which is a beautiful section. And, of course, you can all pretty easily grasp the meanings of those terms. But I think,
and that is the final paper of part two.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a serious paper. I mean, it's a serious position within the book also. So it's interesting that it was given to Macaventa to co-author that paper with a mighty messenger. And mighty messengers, of course, are ascended mortals who have reached, you know, a high level of ascension.
Talk about your dynamic duo.
Yeah, what a great partnership. Yeah. Think about that kind of collaboration. But anyway, yeah, that would be a paper to try to read sometime. A lot of great stuff in it.
Yeah, it is interesting the way it comes as the capper to parts one and two. It's almost like what they're saying is, okay, we've spent all this time providing you the big, big picture, and here's, in a sense, our philosophic summary of what's going on here before we delve into, we leave the big picture sort of in the background and really begin to focus on what's been happening on your particular world.
Right.
So it's an interesting juncture.
Yeah, having that frame of universal unity. I mean, that somehow it all gets unified. Mm-hmm. Well, like you're saying, everything that presented up to that point, and then everything that follows. to have that
the
sort
big
of
cosmology
moment.
Actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's what you've gotten up to that point. You've gotten part one, the central and super universe, and then part two, the local universe. So you've gotten the whole cosmology, essentially.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing, right? Yeah.
Well, I sort of put that paper alongside things like, I think it's Supreme and Ultimate Time and Space.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, for not for the philosophically faint of heart.
Right.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Kind of like forward to, of course. Yeah.
And that one comes almost at the end of part three, Marvin, interestingly. There's one paper after that, and that's the Bestowal of Christ, Bestowals of Christ Michael, which, of course, is an amazing paper. But you can't name one that isn't amazing in its own way. And what's, to me, so incredible is in every single one, you think, well, I wouldn't be too interested in energy, mind, and matter, you know? But then you read it and you think, wow,
yeah,
there's
you find
things
a lot
in
more
there
yeah,
that you wouldn't dream. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and they have ways of embedding nuggets. Even in the most difficult papers,
that'll
be like a paragraph. It's like a nugget of like the priceless truth you can actually grasp.
Yeah.
You go, wow,
right.
I'm glad I read that paper just to find that one paragraph.
It keeps you going, and it expanding.
Yeah.
It expands you. You know, even if you don't quite get what they're exactly saying, there's something that happens on a very deep level. I've always felt that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because when I first read it at 20, you know, most of it went over my head, especially papers like that. But the more I read them, and especially with guys like you, you know, with scholars that have read and studied for years and years, and we've come up in this thing together. That's what's kind of what's definitely magical about it. You know, our friend John Hay started the Boulder School, and back in the day when I was a new reader, one of the best Urantia scholars around was Jim McNally. And he just had such a wonderful grasp on the teachings. And I had the pleasure of being able to ride the study group. We used to ride together. I lived in Brighton and he lived in Thornton. And we'd meet and ride down to Denver to Jim and Joanne Brummett's house. And we'd get to talk. And as a new student, having him right there to say, okay, so Jim, what are they getting at when they say this? Or when they say that. Well, John was so impressed with McNally's understanding of the book that that's why he created the Boulder School. I don't know if you guys know that or not, but he thought that wouldn't it be great? Yeah, he thought it would be great if every study group had a Jim McNally in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, someone really well versed and just comprehensively in the teachings, so that when a question came up in group, there would be somebody in that group who could answer the question pretty well. And that was Jim for almost any study group he was in. And that's what inspired John to create the Boulder Schools. Like, wouldn't it be great if every study group had somebody like Jim McNally in it who could answer questions? And Andre, you play that role so much. I mean, I hear we're in study every Tuesday night, most study group. It's a wonderful group. I highly recommend it. It's been feeding me since 1986, the Boulder Study Group. And this is where it is now. It's a Zoom group every Tuesday night. And Mo hosts it. But people will say, well, let's ask our resident scholar, Andre.
Oh, yeah.
And Andre always gets kind of, you know, how you're so humble, Andre, and it's wonderful. But it's just important that every study group have that person. And I feel blessed to be with three of you right here in this same group. So that's wonderful. We get some great
questions. Yeah, it's wonderful to have that quality of study. It's also just wonderful to, I think, in any study group, to have a wide variety of people from different walks of life, which you're almost guaranteed with the Urantia book, because one thing, I mean, there are different things that corroborate its authenticity. But these days, it's not so much what it says that corroborates that for me, at least not directly. It's the people it attracts. That's what corroborates the authenticity for me. It's number one, you know, it's attracting people that are hungry for truth.
Right.
And
right.
have generally been looking for a while, or they may have just started. They may have started late in life. They may have always had that hunger since they were very, very young, but it attracts those people. But the other thing that's just remarkable about it is it's not one kind of person. People that are hungry for truth come from really, literally all walks of life. And so we end up
right.
with people that we, you know, it's like some other groups that are very mixed say, you know, we are people that would not ordinarily mix. No, I never would have gotten to meet mm-hmm. most of the people
yeah, you
know, that
mm-hmm.
that I have
known.
People
in the
Urantia
you probably
movement.
Would never have known otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah. It never would have happened.
I'm just saying you meet people and get to know people that you probably
yeah,
would never have
exactly.
met otherwise.
Exactly.
Because there's no other common ground.
That's what's so
amazing
about it, really. Scientists
yeah.
and PhDs and CEOs and doctors and and you're in this,
mm-hmm.
you know, and therapists and, you know,
and carpenters
and
carpenters.
And
carpenters you know,
and carpenters, yes.
Yeah.
And they're all thinkers.
You know,
that's what we all have in common.
What have you. Yeah.
Right. And true.
In all walks
right.
of life, really.
And that's wonderful. That's what's so wonderful about it. I mean, just recently, and I know
them.
Marvin, yeah, and artists. And both artists and, you know, engineers that at the same time, you know, very whole-brained people who are adept at many things. And, you know, to me, it's such a wealth. I feel so blessed to have known so many Urantia book readers. And it's, of course, you know, we might have a tendency to just get used to hanging out with each other because we really feed each other that way. And it's
yeah.
hard sometimes to go out and try to talk to somebody who could pretty much care less about some of this stuff, you know. Judy on the board says, and goofballs like me. Judy, you're one of the most, the sweetest goofball I've ever met. You're so creative. You're just like off the charts creatively. I've never met anybody as creative and fun as you, Trudy Cooper. You are the best. I love you.
I don't know whether to think of Trudy as a comedian who's a minister or a minister who's a comedian. I don't know.
See, that makes the point, doesn't it? That and it's just so rich and beautiful. And I know that Marvin, you do you're all three of you are so engaged always in teaching. You know, Chuck and Derek are doing their studies, and it's wonderful to see that starting to take off. You know, getting more and more listeners to that. Marvin is doing Cosmic Cafes and deeply involved with Urantia University. Andre, you're doing the same thing with Urantia University, deeply involved with study groups and the fellowship. It's wonderful. Thank you, guys, for that, you know, because we're just still a small little movement on this planet, just a drop mm-hmm. in the ocean of humanity, you know, and we have this epical revelation to disseminate.
Yeah.
And it is, to Marvin's point, it is an emergency, I think. You know, the world needs
it. Yeah, it's always an emergency around here.
Yeah.
But I just noticed something interesting. And going back to the paper that we're studying, in the previous section was this, the Melt Pig Cake. section two, the Melchizedek signs. I think we read that last time. Anyway, in connection with this idea, the idea that McAvena had a hand in that universal unity paper and how far that reaches, that paper, how far that reaches into the maybe the future of human comprehension of reality. It's like kind of maybe beyond us now, but it won't be necessarily forever. Anyway, they make this comment that the Melchizedeks, this is in 35:27, the Melchizedeks are the teachers who so often win whole worlds of advanced life to the final and full recognition of the Creator Son and His Paradise Father. I don't know. That's a pretty strong statement.
Whole world.
Yeah.
Well, it makes you wonder just how.
So often win whole worlds.
It does make you wonder that.
Of advanced life. So I'm assuming they're talking about a planet, you know, on the verge of light and life, maybe even enlightened life. I don't know. But I know that they work together with the Trinity Teacher Sons. So the Trinity Teacher Sons are the ones who kind of come in and try to get the evolving world over the hump into light and life, generally. At least that's how I think of them. But this comment about the Melchizedeks being involved in that in this particular way as teachers, winning whole world. I mean, I don't know. That sounds, it kind of fits though with that universal unity paper in a funny way. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. But I'm thinking about world. Yeah.
Doesn't it occur to you, that advancement is, you know, mass communication, global communication is a very important advancement for a world? It's tricky, but important. And I think that must be how Eleonora was able to win over her whole planet, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking about Eleonora as well. Yeah.
Yeah. There had to have been some way that her communications reached the whole globe in a fairly reasonable amount of time.
The entire human race.
Yeah. She turned the whole thing back from rebellion and didn't have, you know, whatever she said. That's something we got to look forward to, my friend.
Too, right? By Melchizedek in that.
That's right.
Do they say that?
I'll put the quote up. It's 53:71, yeah.
Cool.
I'm putting it up right now. We can read it.
So there's a good example of how Melchizedek helped win a whole world? Yeah. That's a prime
By the way, I think it's just a wonderful feature of life in your Rancher community that we start developing a cultural lexicon, you know, such that, you know, when I was in my 20s, I'd hear, you know, Crystal Garrick talking about women in the movement and saying, you know, is she thinking she's Eleonora Panopsha, you know, and making those kinds of things. And you knew what she meant. At least some of us did.
Yeah, it's pretty obscure for most people.
It's pretty obscure.
Yeah, but you know, that's the point. That's the point, isn't it, Chuck? You know, and Marvin and Paula, you know, we, as we get to know this and as we really internalize it, and as the culture spreads and people begin, you know, fraternizing, you know, have just being friends around this and stuff comes up because it's part of your ground. It gets into the culture. And at some point, it will be a thing. Who does she think she is? Eleonora Panopsha? Or, wow, she's a real
Eleonora
Panopsha. Yeah. The light turned green. What do you think he is, Amadon? Will he still stand unmoved forever?
Exactly. It's an inside joke, but it makes us sound a little weird. Let's face it. And, you know,
right now,
I always go
right
back
now,
years.
We're weird.
Years ago,
we're just
we
ahead
were
of
at,
our time.
We did it. We did an expo together. Marvin will remember this well. I'm sure we were in Seattle, and after the expo, we worked really hard all weekend long. We talked about the Orangia book until we were blue in the face with everybody under the sun. Meeting people from all walks of life, and we would always go out for a meal afterwards and debrief. And Marvin was telling us these stories. Humorous Urantia stories, and one was about one of our illustrious leaders, and I don't remember who it was. I always imagine it was somebody like Steve Dreyer, though, who went to look at a conference site at a Lutheran, I think it was Lutheran or Christian conference center anyway, and he was walking along with the minister, and the minister was pretty tied into New Age thinking, at least, or more hip to it. And they were walking along, and the minister asked this person, "So what do you guys called again?" And the Urantia book reader said, "Well, we're the Urantia book fellowship." And the minister said, "Oh, yes, right. And what's Urantia again?" And without thinking, the reader said, "Well, it's the name of our planet." And then to which the minister said, "Oh, yeah, so where is this planet you're from?" Do you remember who that was, Marvin, who was the person that was looking at the site?
Well, it's one of those
was that
stories
Steve?
That floats. Yeah, it's one of those
that
stories
floats?
That floats around. Yeah, and my recollection is that it was Steve, and it was in the Northeast. They were looking for a small conference, and it was the director of that facility, and they said, "Oh yeah, well, what, where is this planet you're from?" Everyone had a good chuckle. Yeah,
yeah.
But you know, one of the things. Oh, go ahead, Paula. Yeah, go finish up.
Well, I just wanted to share the other story he told us that night, which made the whole table howl, and that was of Julia Fenderson and how she used to love every once in a while to have a Urantia costume party at study group, and everybody would come dressed as a character from the Urantia book. And
yeah,
one night, unbeknownst to a new reader who came, and the foundation had sent him there, gave him the address, and sent him to Julia's house, and there was this costume party going on, and Julia was dressed up as Mother Eve, and Marvin said she had a flashlight behind her head to make a glow. And she answered the door, and here is this new reader. You know, and all these weirdos in there in their costumes and stuff, and the guy was like, "Uh-oh."
And apparently this new guy thought he was just coming to a regular study group. He didn't realize that's what this
always
was.
Like that.
Right. Julie introduced herself as Mother Eve.
Yeah. And this guy took a look around. He looked through the doorway and said, "Thank you. I'll come back another time." And they never saw him again.
Oh my God!
No, of course not. But that's, you know, those are the things we'll take to paradise with us. Those memories and stories like that—they'll be their treasures, really, because of the, you know, just what you were saying, Andre. The strange vernacular we end up having for having been a Urantia book reader.
Well, you know, I was thinking a little bit about sort of the juxtaposition of our particular set of circumstances and that far distant time when we might also have a Melchizedek who sort of, in a sense, wins the last remnants of world civilization to an acceptance of the reality of the Father and the reality of who Jesus, Michael, our sovereign is, and just the whole context of who we are in the universe. And what's really interesting is this is such an interesting time and period and set of circumstances to be alive so early in the trajectory of this fifth epical revelation. And you know, arguably, the Urantia revelation really opens the big picture for us. Jesus gave us the entree. I mean, he described our spiritual situation in deep and provocative terms, you know, and brought us home to to a real nurturing and loving relationship with a father, and with him and with the Mother Spirit. But even then, he was able to share such a small amount of what the reality is. And for the first time, really, with this fifth epical revelation, we have a window into the vastness and the complexity of what's going on in the cosmos and what we're part of, mm-hmm. in a way that no other generations have ever really had before. And what's so interesting to me is here we are such a tiny, tiny minority of people who have this perspective. And what they're speaking of in regard to this Melchizedek that you brought up the passage, Chuck, they're speaking of a far distant time where the last remnants of the civilization are brought under into that understanding, into that full realization. Right. So it's like at the other end of this historical trajectory that we are at the beginning of in many ways. So it's just interesting to have lived our lives in that set of circumstances, to be sort of, in a sense, in an extreme sense, almost forerunners of that eventual reality.
To
really reflect on that a lot when I think about, I mean, we're old enough to look back on our lives and you know, our whole history with this movement and this revelation and reflect on it. And that's something I reflect on fairly often.
Mm-hmm.
What a challenge, but what an amazing opportunity it has been and continues to be in association with this particular revelation in its early inception. And to wrestle with how to serve, you know, how to do our part in the procession of the generations, you know, how do we play our part effectively? And do something good for the progress of our world, you know, when we are in such chaos in so many ways, and yet we're in association with the ultimate vision of order and coherence and purpose, you know. And so it's really a remarkable privilege to live the life in these circumstances, I think.
Well, and here come the Webb telescope, and now all of a sudden people are seeing this universe of universes that we know all about. You know?
Yeah.
It's amazing to look at those images from the perspective of the Urantia book. It's just amazing. What we don't understand as a planet is, why don't we know if there's life out there? But even we know why that's true. That's been withheld from us. That's part of our challenge, really. That's part of what makes life on this planet so challenging. That isolation, that feeling of cosmic orphanhood. Like there's something going on out there, but we're not a part of it. You know, and now we're hearing this heartbeat in space and we're thinking, wow, what's that?
Well, you know, every now and then, Paula,
filled with wonder.
Just to that point, every now and then, I take a look at the distance between what our current culture is attempting to grab hold of and what the reality is. I mean, if you think about it, right, we're still trying to figure out if there is any life at all out in the cosmos. Well, not only is there life, but there's... The next question is there intelligent life that is capable of communication the way we understand it on this world with each other? And that's just the next way. Then the next question is that happening in more than one or two places? And the reality is it's massively prevalent. It's everywhere that there's intelligent life.
It's everywhere.
And not only that, but... it's intelligent life that is spiritually sensitive and questing everywhere. And not only that, but there's a continuity between those evolutionary initial lives and an eternal ascension scheme of spiritual growth as spiritual beings in the upcoming life. So it's like we are so primitive in our search on these fundamental questions we're so much at the barest beginning of understanding what's going on in the cosmos. And here we are with this vision of all these realities fully unfolded for us with this revelation. It's such an odd juxtaposition of factors that we're in the middle of, you know, how we get to live our lives. You know, the majority of the world culture is saying, is there any other life out there, let alone any of the rest of it? It's just, it's a crazy distance, really, between where our culture is and what we understand from this body of revelation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
It's here for a reason.
I think it speaks to the importance of teaching, among other things. I mean, that little, mm-hmm. that little quote about, you know, Melchizedek, it's through their teaching that they... This is, they're the teachers who so often win whole worlds. So you think of your answer book as a body of teaching, but
mm-hmm.
of course it's not a living personality, even though it's created by living personalities. So, but then it kind of falls on us to try to understand and comprehend it so we can teach it, you know, is a feeling I'm getting. And that's obviously very, very, very important. Or the... Even thinking of Eleonora, you know, she was sort of in a role of a teacher in a sense. I mean, she had to have been. She had to be able to explain what was happening so people would understand it and then act, you know, in a wise way. And
mm-hmm.
oftentimes, that, you know, we depend on good teachers to show us paths of wisdom. And, you know, I think we're called on to become those, you know, step into that, any of us at least that feel like it or feel inclined. Because the need is so great. But what, to me, what's exciting is like we'd be almost partnering directly with Macaventa in those kind of things. Because we know he's going to be with this planet. He's tied to this planet going forward into probably all the way to light and life. So he may be the Melchizedek like that they talk about way far in the future that does finally win this planet completely for the Father. But in
you know,
the meantime...
I wouldn't doubt that at all.
Yeah. I mean, this thing about him stepping into his role as vicegerent mm-hmm. planetary prince, I mean, that's a huge thing to think about that. And to think about him is that, you know, taking on that responsibility and that role. And every time I look at the Universal Unity paper, I think, okay, we're going to be in for some high-level... I don't know what.
Well, like a lot of eldest children, the Melchizedeks kind of steal the show. And, you know, very often it's the middle children that don't get, you know, as much attention. They get short shrift. At least I'm aware of some middle children that say that. And lo and behold, we're on the constellation Fathers.
The middle
children. They are the second sons. Yes, exactly. They're the second sons that are created. And let's not neglect them. Let's, by all means, find out what we're doing here in Section 6. Shall we?
Okay, and before we start, Andre, and that was a great segue, by the way. Thank you for that. there's a quote I want to read. Yeah, very artful, for sure. From paper 51, and it's, of course, about the seven fathers. Just so we have a sense before we get into the constellation fathers, this is 5166.
Mm-hmm.
With the passing of the centuries, through the amalgamation of their progeny with the races of men, these same material son and daughter become accepted as the common ancestor of mankind, the common parents of the now blended descendants of the evolutionary races. It is intended that mortals who start out from an inhabited world have the experience of recognizing seven fathers. One, the biologic father, the father in the flesh. Two, the father of the realm, the planetary Adam. Three, the father of the spheres, the system sovereign. Four, the most high father, the constellation father. Five, the universe father, the creator son and supreme ruler of the local universe, the local creations. 6, the superfathers, the ancients of days who govern the super universe. And 7, the spirit or Havona father, the universal father, who dwells on paradise and bestows his spirit to live and work in the minds of the lowly creatures who inhabit the universe of universes. And that's not to take away from the mother companions of and associates of all of those wonderful 7 fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. So we're going to be talking about the constellation father right now. But, of course, I always get a touch by the...
Right in the middle of the list.
Yep, right in the middle.
Yeah.
Our own Jesus is our universe father. How special is that? So,
mm-hmm.
Okay. So I just wanted to read that before we read about the constellation fathers.
Interesting. They refer to the ancients of days as super fathers.
Yeah.
I don't recall seeing that phrase anywhere else in the book. Super
fathers. I think so, yeah.
Anyway.
Well, who'd like to read that?
Go ahead.
So are we on section 6 or section 5?
Section 6.
Did we finish section 5
last week, yeah.
Right.
Oh, we did, okay.
Or 2 weeks ago, rather.
2 weeks ago, right.
All right.
Yeah. The constellation fathers. At least 3 Baran Zedeks are assigned to the rulership of each of the 100 constellations of a local universe. These suns are selected by the Creator Sun and are commissioned by Gabriel as the most highs of the constellations of service during one decamillennium, 10,000 standard years, about 50,000 years of Urantia time. Mm-hmm. The reigning Most High, the Constellation Father, has 2 associates, a senior and a junior. At each change of administration, the senior associate becomes the head of the government. The junior assumes the duties of the senior, while the unassigned Baran Zedeks resident on the Salvation Worlds nominate one of their number as candidate for selection to assume the responsibilities of junior associate. Thus, each of the Most High rulers, in accordance with present policy, has a period of service on the headquarters of a constellation of 3 decamillenniums, about 150,000 Urantia years.
Wow.
That's beyond our reckoning, generally.
Yeah.
The 100 constellation fathers, the actual presiding heads of the constellation governments, constitute the Supreme Advisory Cabinet of the Creator Sun. This council is in frequent session at universe headquarters and is unlimited in the scope and range of its deliberations, but is chiefly concerned with the welfare of the constellations and with the unification of the administration of the entire local universe. When a constellation father is in attendance upon duties at the universe headquarters, as he frequently is, the senior associate becomes acting director of constellation affairs. The normal function of the senior associate is the oversight of spiritual affairs, while the junior associate is personally occupied with the physical welfare of the constellation. No major policy, however, is ever carried out in a constellation unless all 3 of the Most Highs are agreed upon all the details of its execution. The entire mechanism of spirit intelligence and communication channels is at the disposal of the constellation Most Highs. They are in perfect touch with their superiors on Salvington and with their direct subordinates, the sovereigns of the local systems. They frequently convene in council with these system sovereigns to deliberate upon the state of the constellation. The Most Highs surround themselves with a corps of counselors, which varies in number and personnel from time to time in accordance with the presence of the various groups at constellation headquarters and also as the local requirements vary. During times of stress, they may ask for and will quickly receive additional Sons of the Verandadec Order to assist with the administrative work. Relationship, your own constellation, is at present administered by 12 Verandadec Sons. Ho ho. Normally 3, 12 for us.
I wonder why. That struck me. Well, why 12? I wonder. It, because of the rebellion,
explain it.
Do you think?
Well, that's part of it. That's
well, they
one
say
of the
they
reasons.
Have a group around them.
Mm. So, they need the council, the extra, the help
the,
for whatever
there's
reason.
There's the three main, the three main ones. But then they apparently have a staff or...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they drill down in paper 43 a little bit more to talk about some of the government. Mm-hmm. And let me just see, the Adentia Father since the Lucifer Rebellion, that might be a good segue to this section if somebody wants to read it. It's paper 5 of section 5 of paper 43, and it's not a long read. But it goes through the list of the 12 and explains that. So if somebody wants to read that, that would be a good point of drilling down in this discussion.
I could read that if you want.
Okay, cool.
Sounds good.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good suggestion, I think. Excuse me. Okay, so it's paper 43, section 5, the Adentia Fathers, since the Lucifer Rebellion, the title of the section. And they say the rotation of the Most Highs on Adentia was suspended. So the rotation would be that 150,000 year cycle, perhaps. The rotation
of
the Most Highs on Adentia was suspended at the time of the Lucifer Rebellion. We now have the same rulers who are on duty at that time. And it's been longer, of course, than those 50 or 150 cycles. We infer that no change in these rulers will be made until Lucifer and his associates are finally disposed of. Oh, that's interesting. Disposed of, is a nice way of putting it.
So that's
putting it mildly.
That's 300,000 years ago, right? Yeah. So they've been on
a
twice
double
as long so far.
200,000 years ago.
Yeah, 200.
Oh, okay.
But that's still longer than either 50 or 100.
50, yeah.
It is, yeah.
Okay.
And
present
who knows
government,
how long it will be.
Yeah, right. We have no idea.
So present to Marvin's point, that senior mode, the Constellation Father would have already been there 100,000 years. It would have been sometime during the term, right? So...
Right.
Very good point
there,
Marvin.
It
would have been at least 300,000 years for the Constellation Father. Yeah.
Well.
Oh wow.
Well,
okay.
We don't know how long he'd been there.
We can assume that sometime in the term, right, that he could have been there anywhere from 100,000, nearly 150,000 years. So he's been there at least 300,000 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Good catch, Andre. Marvin, too.
Okay. All righty. So, but they hold them in those positions when there's rebellion, apparently. They suspend the rotation.
Yeah. Everything stops. Everything is held in place. It's like waiting to exhale or something.
Something like that.
Well, and the other thing is at the end of that paragraph, that very first short paragraph, they say, we infer that no change in these rulers will be made until Lucifer and his associates are finally disposed of. So they probably have seen this kind of circumstance in previous universe history, and the assumption is that in the midst of all that transition, that you hold things steady in terms of the administration. You don't change in the middle. Those beings that were in charge stay in charge until things can reach a place of greater stability, probably, is almost the inference. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It makes perfect sense, too.
Mm-hmm. And also running through this is the relationship between systems and constellations.
Mm-hmm.
That when they talk about the quarantine of Satania, it's to keep open the ascension pathway for beings from Norlashidek. In other words, the system can jeopardize the constellation.
Yeah.
In rebellion scenarios. So that's why. That's why they bring in the quarantine, is to protect the constellation.
Yeah.
So anyway, just running through all this is just get the sense there's an intimate relationship between the systems and the constellations.
Right.
You know, and what we were just reading a minute ago too, they talk about how the Most High has turned to the system sovereigns for counsel. You know, and they all meet together and stuff. So it's interesting. Even though there's intervening levels of organization, right? Between the constellations and or maybe not. Systems constellation. No, it's the next level up, sorry. The sectors are beyond constellation level.
They're beyond the local universe, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Okay, anyway, well, I'll keep reading here. They say the present government of the constellation, however, has been expanded to include 12 sons of the Virandadek order. Ah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this was not normal before. This is adaptation because of rebellion, it sounds like. Okay, so these 12 are as follows. 1, the constellation father, the present Most High ruler, Norlashidek, is number 617,318 of the Virandadek series of Nebadon. He saw service in many constellations throughout our local universe before taking up his Edentia responsibilities. 2, the senior Most High associate. 3, the junior Most High associate. 4, the Most High advisor, the personal representative of Michael since his attainment of the status of a master son. That's interesting. Mm. 5, the Most High executive, the personal representative of Gabriel stationed on Edentia ever since the Lucifer rebellion. 6, the Most High chief of planetary observers, the director of the Virandadek observers stationed on the isolated worlds of Satania. That's right, there's a Virandadek observer on each of the rebellion worlds, right, including ours.
Right. Mm-hmm.
7,
wow.
The Most High Referee, the Virandadek son, entrusted with the duty of adjusting all difficulties consequential to rebellion within the constellation. Let me read that again. The Most High Referee, the Virandadek son, entrusted with the duty of adjusting all difficulties consequential to rebellion within the constellation. Wow. I bet that keeps him busy. Huh. 8.
Okay.
No, I was just thinking. He almost, well, whatever. I was just thinking about
a lot of consequences.
Conciliating commissions and other groups that go around and try to iron out difficulties. So this sounds something like something similar to that. And maybe oversees that or is, I don't know, but that's interesting.
A referee, yeah, that would
yeah, a referee, they would use that
indicate
term.
That.
I think of Rhonda just kind of strikes you. Anyway, 8, the Most High Emergency Administrator, the Virandadek son charged with the task of adapting the emergency enactments of the Norlashidek legislature to the rebellion-isolated worlds of Satania. Hmm. So that must be legislative enactments. Huh. Okay. 9, the Most High Mediator, the Virandadek son assigned to harmonize the special bestowal adjustments on Urantia with the routine administration of the constellation. The presence of certain archangel activities and numerous other irregular ministrations on Urantia, together with the special activities of the brilliant evening stars on Terusin necessitates the functioning of this sun.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to pull apart there. But we know about the archangel circuit on this planet. So that's obviously a big example of what they're talking about. Harmonizing special adjustments.
Bestowal adjustments.
Bestowal adjustments,
so,
right. All the things about your answer that are, kind of special and different. Having been not just out of, that's part of it, no doubt. But having been the bestowal war for Michael, all kinds of things are different about this planet, which we may not realize just walking down the street. But the archangel headquarters here, or whatever, the archangel circuit on this planet is one of those things that apparently is related to the fact that this is Michael's bestowal world. And then they mention other things too, numerous other irregular ministrations. I don't know what that could be referring to. But that's interesting. Well, I mean, the Council of 24, the resident governor general, just the whole scheme of governance, of course, is adapted. So it may include some of those things as well. Who knows? Okay, so number 10, the Most High Judge Advocate, the head of the emergency tribunal devoted to the adjustment of the special problems of Nor-Lashadec growing out of the confusion consequent upon the Satania rebellion. Makes me wonder how much, I thought it was contained within Satania, or the rebellion itself.
It is.
I guess it maybe has consequences beyond Satania, though.
Yes.
I mean,
sure.
What's
it like if you're Moldova next to Ukraine? There's big problems with your next door neighbor right now that can have big consequences for you.
And for the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's the point.
Right.
This is clearly, most of this is about the rebellion. It's clearly. This was the event.
Yeah, no, these
that,
are all
that,
the rebellion adaptations.
Yeah. Right.
Except for number four,
number
which was about the bestowal.
Right. So we can't really say that was caused by the rebellion.
But his presence
wasn't, though, either.
Presence in this group may very well have something to do with the rebellion.
Well, they say we provided a great contrast for him to be able to,
But
be
in
able
other
to
words,
come here in contrast.
But this expansion of the team from 3 to 12, all of these additional bronze decks all seem to have something to do with managing the affairs during this period of adjudication from the rebellion. So it makes sense that Michael would want to have a representative, a personal representative, in the middle of this effort.
Yeah,
but I don't know. Okay, let's see. Where did I leave off? Number 11?
10, I
think. Most High.
I think so, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
10. Okay, I read 10. Oh, well, no worries. The Most High Judge Advocate, the head of the Emergency Tribunal, devoted to the adjustment of the special problems in Nor-Lashadec growing out of the confusion consequent upon the Satania rebellion. Yeah, so I was wondering how that kind of, anyway. Number 11, the Most High Liaison, the Verondadec son attached to the Adenture rulers, but commissioned as a special counselor with the Faithful of Days regarding the best course to pursue in the management of problems pertaining to rebellion and creature disloyalty. Now, Faithful of Days, that's a paradise personality, right? Don't they come
that's
from?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a special counsel. So there's a Verondadec side attached to Udentia. To the Adensia rulers, but commissioned as a special counselor to the Faithful of Days regarding the best course. Okay, and then 12.
It seems like less two and with. the Faithful of Days. The Faithful of Days is going to have, you know, the Council of Paradise. So
right.
It may be that he's counseling with the Faithful of Days in order to derive what he can for both to have both the wisdom
of what
paradise
it says with
experiential
right.
wisdom. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That with is an important word in that sentence. Wait, this also reminds me of the, you know, when they talk about the problems of the Lucifer Rebellion and, the delays and, you know, they have a long list of advice that was given from all levels about, you know, how to handle rebellion. And some of what we're reading here was the source of some of that advice. So it's interesting to kind of tie this together with that, you know, what they tell us in that other paper about the, you know, the compiling of wisdom about rebellion. You know, what do we do? You know, the Mother Spirit had her pronouncement, and then they came from all different sources, including the ascending mortals and Brand of X2, I believe, and maybe Faithfuls of Days. In other words, what I'm getting here is that the rebellion in Satania affected the whole constellation in some way, in some seemingly some profound ways, even though the rebellion didn't spread to the rest of the constellation. The constellation was affected by it, you know, in ways that, I don't know, hard to understand probably. But
Andre,
okay.
How many worlds are in a constellation? Before we go on, how many worlds
what?
Would be affect worlds inhabited worlds?
100,000 potentially. 100,000 potentially, and probably at the present time, if we're an average constellation, then about 38,000-39,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, constellation has 100 systems.
So we're just this 36 planets. Is that right?
000. What's that?
Just
we're,
36
we're
37,
planets? No, 37 rebellion planets out of the 619.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all that were quarantined in Satania. Mm-hmm. Remember, there were 38 planetary princes that went, but the people did not go with the planetary prince on Panopsia.
Right.
Because of
Elmora. Thanks to
Elnora.
Thanks
to
and the Melchizedek. Yeah.
So that we have.
So it would have been
38.
Would
have been 38 otherwise, right?
But
it wasn't. So that's what's happening in Satania. And then, you know, Satania, all of Satania is affected by the fact that there was, you know, the rebellion on high, even though, literally, 580 planets or thereabouts, you know, did not go into rebellion.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And still it makes a big difference, the 37 that did. And, you know, finally, you look and the fact that, I mean, to me, the thing that would be sort of the mundane kind of aspect to how it's affecting things, we all come from rebellion-isolated worlds and from a rebellion-isolated system. Can you imagine what it's like receiving mortals, even though we have spiritualized, we've grown past those things, but we have an experiential set that does not mesh with the experiential set of 99 other systems.
Mm.
We have some very unusual experiences that require probably harmonization of one kind or another. Mm. So it's not necessarily a bad thing or anything, but it is a problem in the sense that there's probably an element of unrelatability among those that never experienced anything close to this.
You know, what strikes me is it's like a, so what comes to my mind is how the body sense a lot of cells to counteract a foreign, you know, object in the order of the system, right? Or how a fire breaks out, and if we're lucky and smart, we can hit it with everything we got to put it out before it takes over a monument like, you know, the Grizzly Giant in Yosemite. You know, it feels like that to me. So we're all thinking about the emergency nature of this revelation on this world, but this really drives home the point of the emergency nature of the rebellion in the constellation, happening in the constellation. And even though it's a minuscule part, how quickly they acted to isolate it and keep it contained. And how important that is.
I think you make an excellent point in bringing up the sickness model of thinking about this. I mean, that's why they use quarantine. That's why they talk about this. Think about the fact that, you know, we have had a pandemic where, you know, not everybody's getting sick. A tiny virus is getting people sick because it's able to outrun the immune system for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Unless that immune system's been somehow artificially prepared. And as a result of that, just think about this simple analogy. That little virus makes your whole body feel sick. It's not just this part of me feels sick. I feel sick, you know?
Right.
When I catch the flu or a cold, or doesn't matter what it is that I catch, but
or if you get an infection,
that's the point.
Yeah,
you know, it's largely a vascular disease. You know, to go further, it's really mainly attacking one aspect of the system, but that aspect of the system serves all the rest of the systems. That makes a big difference.
Wow. So these revelations are like our antibodies, our
the universe dose
of antibiotics. Yeah,
we're getting the vaccine,
and we will act as that vaccine in the universe. That's interesting. We will be like that vaccine in the universe. Rebellion tested.
Rebellion
and
tested.
Anti venom. Yeah.
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 You know. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, you know, one of the strangest parts of all this, you guys were mentioning before, is the feeling of isolation as a planet. That we don't have visible superhuman presence on the planet. So that's why people ask and wonder if there's life anywhere else in the universe. That question, which seems so ridiculous once you sort of understand what's going on, is created by the circumstances that we face here, where it does seem like this planet is a fluke in the universe. You know, that who knows if there's life anywhere else. You know, it's so easy to ask that question because we don't have any higher representation of administration that could help us understand the place of this world in a larger scheme of things. So rebellion, at least in our case, took that away, because not only our planetary prince, but also Adam and Eve, you know, they were, you know, the main gifts to this planet of visible presence have been taken away as a consequence of the rebellion, either directly or indirectly. And Adam and Eve didn't intend that, but still, it was a consequence. So that's a strange peculiarity that is not normal. You know, it's not there. You know, normal worlds don't wonder if there's life in the universe, right?
Yeah, nothing like normal.
Peculiar feature of living on this planet. And that's going to have interesting repercussions going forward. Yeah, I think maybe Andre, you're suggesting.
I agree.
You know, oddly enough, that'll qualify us for, you know, like they talk about the Agadons, you know. We have a peculiar,
cool assignment.
A peculiar quality of confidence in unseen realities because we have to. You can't just run down the street and talk to Adam or talk to Eve or something. You know, we have to depend on we have to find God within ourselves. We have to find spirit reality within ourselves and compensate in all kinds of ways that produce growth, special kinds of growth.
And wisdom.
That I'm sure will have.
Hard fought, hard won.
Going forward, So anyway, should I finish this up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're up to number 12, the Most High Director. Okay, the Most High Director. President, the President of the Emergency Council. So these 12, or at least 9 of the 12, are, I think, what they mean by Emergency Council here.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So the President
that's a good
of the Emergency Council of Udentia, I mean, maybe it goes beyond that, but all personalities assigned to Narlashadeck because of the Satania upheaval constitute the Emergency Council. Oh, okay. And their presiding officer is a Verandadeck of extraordinary experience. Good to know. And this takes no account of the numerous Verandadecks, envoys of Nebadon constellations, and others who are also resident on Udentia. Ever since the Lucifer Rebellion, the Udentia Fathers have exercised a special care over Urantia and the other isolated worlds of Satania. Long ago, the prophet recognized the controlling hand of the Constellation Fathers in the affairs of nations. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people. Huh. Interesting. Puzzling.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wonder where that is. It's obviously a Bible, from the Bible somewhere. Every quarantine,
yeah, Daniel,
or isolated...
Daniel, there's a lot of stuff on the Most High, so it might be referring to Daniel somewhere.
Interesting.
Or it could be referring to, where is Abraham talked about, Deuteronomy, somewhere in there, Numbers, Leviticus.
Uh-huh.
Leviticus mainly, I think.
Uh-huh. Huh. Come back and try to figure out what that sentence means.
I'm not a biblical scholar. I wouldn't pretend.
Yeah, yeah.
We've been going through some of those readings in my morning prayer group,
uh-huh.
So I do remember some of that.
Anyway, well, I'll just read this last paragraph. Every quarantined or isolated world has a Verandadeck son acting as an observer. He does not participate in planetary administration except when ordered by the constellation's father to intervene in the affairs of the nations. Actually, it is this Most High Observer who, quote, rules in the kingdoms of men. Urantia is one of the isolated worlds in Narlashadeck, and a Verandadeck observer has been stationed on the planet ever since the Caligastri betrayal. When Machaventa Melchizedek ministered in semi-material form on Urantia, he paid respectful homage to the Most High Observer then on duty. As it is written, quote, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, was the priest of the Most High. Interesting. Melchizedek revealed the relations of this Most High Observer to Abraham when he said, and blessed be the Most High who has delivered your enemies into your hand. Yeah, I was just reading that in the Bible, actually. Huh. Okay.
Wow. Well, there's some interesting quotes in there, biblical and otherwise.
That last sentence, where they say Melchizedek revealed the relations of this Most High Observer to Abraham when he said, quote, and blessed be the Most High who has delivered your enemies into your hand. So get a sense that they intervened in that military battle?
Well, you have to wonder, you know, about things like that.
That's a pretty direct statement, you know. Melchizedek.
Some kind of extraordinary influence. But how that's managed is another question. I mean, you got to probably give Abraham's troops some credit, too, you know what I mean, or whatever. Who knows what that battle was about. But I find it strange that these high social beings would be taking sides in human military conflicts. But I don't know.
Well, if it has
that is the implication.
It has implications for planetary affairs in a larger sense and the spiritual welfare and progression of the planet, which I don't think happens in very many circumstances, but in these, apparently, it might have had some relevance.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think there are probably ways in which they intervene that we wouldn't guess, or we don't understand.
Well, I have a cross-reference along these lines. It's from paper 114.4.4. A Most High Observer is empowered at his discretion to seize the planetary government in times of grave planetary crisis. And it is of record that this has happened 33 times in the history of Urantia. At such times, the Most High Observer functions as the Most High Regent, exercising unquestioned authority over all ministers and administrators resident on the planet, excepting only the divisional organization of the archangels. So it's actually happened 33 times, but it sounds like once he seizes power, it's unquestioned. So,
but then how does that power get exercised on the mortal, physical level? That's a good question, I think.
Through the reserve corps, I think.
What's that?
Because it says that in the Reserve Corps of Destiny section, it says that it's through these humans that the Most High
mm-hmm.
are able to rule in the kingdoms of men. So they
mm-hmm.
somehow activate the Reserve Corps, and they get done what they need to get done. The way I understand it.
But even mm-hmm. with that understanding, it's still hard to picture. A lot of reservists are not even conscious that they're reservists. Some are, but I can see an individual making a critical decision at a critical moment, or offering some critical advice, or having some influence at a pivotal moment that could change the outcome of things. And that must be what they're talking about. But in the case of Abraham and his enemies, I don't know.
You can understand it from the standpoint that, Abraham, they were looking, the Melchizedeks were said to be looking at the family of Abraham for a number of generations
mm-hmm.
and seeing that there would be leadership that would come out of that family. And you know, 1,000 years prior to that, had made the decision and said, they recognized
mm-hmm.
that the light of truth was fading on the planet. So that's a pretty dire circumstance, and understanding that a creator son is about to be bestowed. So given all of that was in line, it was very, very important to put something in place, and you can imagine that this was almost like an emergency power. The idea of the Most
mm-hmm.
High is delivering enemies into the hand. I don't know that you want to look at it too literally. I'm sure it's very subtle how that's done. But
mm-hmm.
it was done for good effect. It wasn't because the Israelis were particularly much better people. But they did have to their advantage that they were becoming monotheistic and had greater potential for that than, say, the surrounding peoples. And so they allowed Abraham and his leadership
mm-hmm.
to overcome those others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the history that unfolded from that point forward down to the current day, I mean, through the bestowal of Michael, and then down through the current day, and you see what they do tell us of the role especially of the Salem missionaries, which wasn't just to the Jewish people, but out to many other cultures all around the planet, and that flowered in the Axial Age, you know, 600 BC, in many parts of the world, but it was the unrecognized actions, functions of the Salem missionaries that dispersed all through the world. And what was happening with the Jewish people at that time was to establish, in a sense, a physically stable, you know, a materially stable context for the training and sending out of those missionaries, and the initiation of the trajectory that was the Jewish religion as the particular context for Michael to bestow in. All those things were critically, critically important, and in order to do that, they needed, you know, he had to build a kingdom that was a stable kingdom where all those activities could unfold over a few generations, and then lasting down until providing a context for Jesus to do his work. So obviously it had tremendous import. And, you know, I think we don't really get it, that they actually foresee those kinds of extensions. They've had so much experience on so many worlds that they're taking actions that have ripples that they can foresee out ahead hundreds and thousands of years, at least in the macro sense. I mean, not the micro, but, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this because of coming up to do this workshop in Chicago about the relationship of the Melchizedek and the Jesus and the Urantian bestowal is sort of being thought out as a triune strategic effort. So I think they look at these things very much in the long term.
In that sense, it makes real sense
that they would assure that there would be enough material stability in that Jewish nation to accomplish those purposes. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's just important to, you know, keep in mind that they don't ordinarily do it. The fact they've only intervened 33 times gives you a sense of how often they thought it was absolutely necessary. That's not very much in the history of humanity. And one of the great questions I think we all would have is, at some point, what were the 33 times? And they might be times that we didn't even imagine. You know, I think of the Russian who stopped nuclear war because he refused to push the button, right? And, you know, the Battle of the Midway, who knows? I mean, there might be, because, you know, with that battle, certain strange and inexplicable things happened to give one side an advantage, you know. But it's just interesting, you know, it will be interesting to find out when they intervened and why. And what was the strategic reason, where they obviously were looking ahead and saw there's potential disaster if this happens, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to be such a fascinating study for us, you know, in terms of ascension life studies. And we're you know, talking about the Vorontsov sons, you know, from the standpoint of leadership and all, but we should understand that, you know, our entire sojourn and training through the constellation, while we're being socialized, we're going to be working and learning about constellation and administration, and then on Edentia, learning how that legislative function actually works. And I think we're going to be blown away. You know, and I can't help. I got to do this because Marvin inspired me. It reminded me, and I was talking with some people recently in the movement about Defending Your Life, that wonderful Albert Brooks movie with Meryl Streep, and, you know, where they die and they're sort of in court to see whether or not they go to their next stage or whatever. And
or come back, right? back here.
And Bob Diamond, right. Bob Diamond, the counselor to the Albert Brooks character, Daniel Miller, says, Daniel knows this. So where were you? I'm just curious, you know, because he didn't show up to court. I'd tell you, but you wouldn't understand. Don't treat me like a moron. Try me. I was trapped near the inner circle of thought. I don't understand. I told you.
I was just trapped near the inner circle.
I'm just relating that to Marvin talking about we can't even begin to imagine how far a Melchizedek can see. We can't even begin to imagine. I mean, when they say they're between the Ancients of Days and us, okay, or even between God and us, I'm not even sure whether I got that right, but they're at least between the Ancients of Days and us, that they can see both ways.
Mm.
Well, holy cow. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the Ancients of Days see everything, feel everything, know everything that's going on in the entire super universe. And so you're halfway between that? What can a Melchizedek see? What does a Melchizedek know? I mean, just contemplating that for a few seconds should humble us.
Yeah, for certain.
But there's also the matter of Lenonadek's son, present on the planet, who is...
Yeah.
You know, they make that odd comment in one part of the book about speaking of the Father. They're not sure if he foreknows acts of sin. Remember that? When they say that?
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know how that applies to Melchizedek's and Lenonadek's, but, you know, Machiavelli would be like the elder brother, the Cagliostro, right? And my sense is they have this battle of wits going on. And it may not be possible to foreknow the free will act of a sinful high son like Cagliostro. You know, he could cook up schemes that, you know, the planetary government may not be able to anticipate. I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me. So part of the, you know, this back and forth that goes on in the history of this world, things get better and things get worse, things get better and things get worse, it kind of strikes me as evidence of this sort of struggle that's going on for control of the affairs of this planet.
Yeah,
it works out on the human level. That's the tricky part of it. I mean, that thing we just read about the seizing the planetary government, that would be the celestial planetary government, I'm assuming.
Right.
Because they say that at such times, the Most High becomes a regent, the Most High Observer becomes a regent and exercises unquestioned authority over all ministers and administrators resident on the planet, being only the divisional organization of the archangels. In other words, seizing control over the celestial administration of the planet. But that, how that then plays out on the human level, how that reaches the human level. I mean, the humans know more about what's going on, you know, can help out in those circumstances. But I don't know. It still leaves a lot of questions open in terms of they have a plan, they're going to try to do something, then Cagliostro comes in at right angles and screws it up. So then they got to adapt and do something else. I mean, I think there's
we've seen that with Adam and Eve.
At least some amount of that going on. Yeah. What's that?
Right. I said Adam and Eve are a prime example of that.
Cagliostro
can come in and screw things up.
Right.
And they were relatively perfect compared to us. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there were a couple of things that struck me in all of what we've been reading today. Just sort of throw it into the mix of the conversation. One is that at the level of the planets and at the level of the system, you have either a planetary sovereign or a system sovereign, which is a single ruler who stays the single ruler, I mean, for very, very long periods of time. Not any rotation, not any training, and singular rulership. And of course, they have an administration, and they have things going on that are deliberative and consultative and et cetera. But at the head of the government, you've got a single executive. At the constellation level, it's interesting. The normal constellation situation, you've got this rotating situation with three of them sort of pooling their wisdom, splitting up the functions, and rotating, you know, from inexperience to sort of the functional head, and then moving into sort of an emeritus status. You know, you've got these three different levels of function. It's much more complex and thorough and rotational and balanced, and a lot of administrative detail that gets developed at the rulership of the constellation that isn't there at the system and the planet level, which kind of struck me initially. The other thing, excuse me, is that with the two events of the rebellion, number one, and then, you know, the decision on Michael's part, way in advance of Melchizedek's, you know, we know that Adam and Eve knew that the plans were developing for him to incarnate on Urantia back when they were initially on the planet. So that's some 30,000 years before Melchizedek ever showed up, or roughly. You know, they knew that was going to happen. So you've got these two very unusual events, the rebellion and then the bestowal of the Michael son. And as a result, they put into effect this incredible, much more complex and layered set of administrative functions and personalities. They ramp out the three-person group to a 12-person group, and there's all kinds of additional administrative responsibilities and activities and learning and teaching and growing. I mean, there's all of a sudden there's so much more going on in this particular constellation than is going on almost anywhere else because of these two huge events, and they adapt to it, and they change the administration. And the other thing that was interesting, sort of related to that in a way, is back to the on the planet, when an emergency occurs, the normal legislative and interactive administration, which is much more kind of complex and multi-layered and consultative, is consolidated in a single person. They're given almost like, what is it when you declare military law and the normal...
Martial law.
Martial law. Yeah, the normal apparatus of a government that has legislative and executive and
process,
process, all basically it goes through changes and becomes much more centralized to deal with the emergency. Mm-hmm. That's
right.
All those things are really interesting in the way they do the administration. I thought so. I was struck by a number of those things.
You know, I was struck also by how vital, how critical communication is. These beings of intelligence, the universe intelligence, and, you know, Andre, to your point about Melchizedek being midway and how important that is, how what a linchpin kind of a position they play, and the vital passing of information and how crucial that is to sustaining the system, the whole system. And I'm not talking about the system. I'm just talking the constellation versus the system. I'm talking about the whole system, the continuity of the whole system, the local universe. Through these vital points of communication and this ability to kick into an emergency mode. And, you know, it is interesting, Marvin, you mentioned that since, Michael decided to come here, probably while, you know, Adam and Eve knew about it, so 30-some-odd thousand years ago, but this whole constellation system had already been in place, this whole emergency system and these, the 12 together working were already in place, already acting on the rebellion and trying to correct these problems and address these problems. So Michael would have taken all of that into account. And I want to point out something that Mo, you've done a lot of introductions to the Arrangement Book with Mo Siegel. And, Mo is the CEO. We all know that about him. And he thinks like a CEO. And many times when he's explaining to a group of people Jesus' role in the universe, it's that of a CEO. And why did Jesus come here? Well, if you're a CEO, you look at all of your sales territories out there, and they're all doing pretty good, except this one. This one territory really struggles. They just cannot get their act together. They just cannot get things firing all at once, to achieve what they could achieve. But you have your choice to go to all of these different territories out there. Which is the CEO would you choose to go to? And people almost always, when he asks that question, say, oh, of course you would go to the one that's struggling because they need you the most. And that's such as we know, a universal attitude of love. You know, the greater the love need, the more does divine love seek to fill that need. Of course he would come here because we were struggling the most. Singularly the most, maybe other planets were struggling just as bad, but we provided a great opportunity for his revelation for everybody because of the contrast we provided.
Go ahead, Mark. Yeah, really interesting thought, Paula. Trouble spot. While you were talking, I just sort of the thought occurred to me that I want to try and piggyback onto what you just shared, and that is, when you take a giant step back and you look at what the deities are trying to accomplish in this universe age, in the age of the Supreme, and what the nature of the Supreme is, you have a situation where God is creating a reality that is the farthest out at the edge of spiritual reality and wanting to participate in the most extreme departures from spiritual reality that are nonetheless salvable and can be learned from and understood. And that to me is one way of understanding the adventure of the Supreme. And nowhere, I think, does that, for lack of a better term, that edgy experience, out at the edge, occur most powerfully and with the greatest learning, the greatest lessons and the greatest learning and the greatest opportunities for spiritual accomplishment. Nowhere does that occur except out at the farthest edge where spiritual reality almost disappears and some of it does disappear and is lost and some of it is salvaged and is retained and learns the lessons. And when they say that our system is so much a school of learning where students are coming from many, many other constellations and even other local universes to see what's going on here in the reclamation work on these rebellion worlds and in this system and in this constellation. This is a laboratory where, in a sense, the most dangerous and risky but the most exciting and valuable in terms of precipitating out truth from error, the most valuable stuff that's going on in the Supreme, in a certain sense, is happening out at this very edge of spiritual reality. And so you realize that what's going on in Adentia is a heroic thing. It's a crazy thing, but it's a heroic thing as well.
Very heroic.
It's a very unusual. It's just not a common thing. So it's interesting to be part of it, you know.
Here's another cross-reference about why Jesus came here, and this is, you guys will recognize this one. It's such a great one. It's from Paper 76, Section 5-7. It says, misfortune has not, however, been the sole lot of Urantia. This planet has also been the most fortunate in the local universe of Nevadon. Urantians should count it all gain if the blunders of their ancestors and the mistakes of their early world rulers so plunged the planet into such a hopeless state of confusion, all the more confounded by evil and sin, that this very background of darkness should so appeal to Michael of Nevadon that he selected this world as the arena wherein to reveal the loving personality of the Father in heaven. It is not that Urantia needed a creator son to set its tangled affairs in order. It is rather that the evil and sin on Urantia afforded the creator son a more striking background against which to reveal the matchless love, mercy, and patience of the Paradise Father. So,
yeah, that's very thought-provoking. Yeah,
I would argue that we did need a creator son to
I would also, thinking about this a lot, I would also extend that sentiment to the nature of this revelation, this Urantia book revelation.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that the nature of the exigencies of this planet have warranted a dramatic and, in some sense, radically innovative attempt at revelation in a book form, providing so much catch-up material in a single step. And one of the things I'm going to be really curious about getting up to the Imagined Worlds is to ask the question, how common is this? Is this unprecedented, the nature of this revelation that we have been in association with, as a consolidation and a way of dramatically multiplying the impact of Jesus' bestowal on this world and for the universe? And is this fifth epical revelation sort of part of the adventure of experimentation and adaptation that is in a sense unprecedented, and they're learning day by day, year by year, you know, century by century, what this kind of an effort can provide for future edification of the cosmos. You know, I think we're involved in something that's kind of rather unusual with all of this. And they don't describe anything like this going on anywhere else in the universe. And I would think if similar things would have happened, they might have wanted to let us know that there are similar efforts going on. But they don't do that, you know. So no. It's one of my wonderings, you know.
Isn't there a quote about that, how unprecedented it is? I know there's a quote about how unprecedented it is that we've been given this much at this level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's one of those ones that's kind of hard to,
going back to Adam and Eve, just to clear up a little detail there, they came 37,000 years ago, and the announcement that your answer was to be that the soul world was, I think, 1,000 years ago. So they didn't know about that future.
While they were here.
And there's a couple of interesting paragraphs that precede the one you just read, Paula, that sort of clear that up. And I think they're also fascinating in terms of the sense of things, you know, the way things turn out is kind of, well, I don't know. I mean, there's outcomes that can't be predicted on many levels, right? There's surprises in terms of events and compensations and wonderful things that happen, which is sort of the intimation of that paragraph you read, that will compensate for the terrible things. But here they're talking about Adam, This is 76.53. They say that Adam knew about the dispensational resurrection, which occurred simultaneously with his arrival on the planet, and he believed that he and his companion would probably be repersonalized in connection with the advent of the next order of sonship. He did not know that Michael, the sovereign of this universe, was so soon to appear on Urantia. He expected that the next son to arrive would be of the Avonal order. Even so, it was always a comfort to Adam and Eve, as well as something difficult for them to ponder the only personal message they ever received from Michael. This message, among other expressions of friendship and comfort, said, and this was after their default, Michael said, "I have given consideration to the circumstances of your default. I have remembered the desire of your hearts ever to be loyal to my Father's will. And you will be called from the embrace of mortal slumber when I come to your rancha. If the subordinate sons of my realm do not send for you before that time." And then they say, and this was a great mystery to Adam and Eve. They could comprehend the veiled promise of a possible special resurrection in this message, and such a possibility greatly cheered them. But they could not grasp the meaning of the intimation that they might rest until the time of a resurrection associated with Michael's personal appearance on Urantia. And so the Edenic pair always proclaimed that a son of God would sometime come, and they communicated to their loved ones the belief, at least the longing hope, that the world of their blunders and sorrows might possibly be the realm whereon the ruler of this universe would elect to function as the paradise bestowed son. It seemed too good to be true. But Adam did entertain the thought that strife toward Urantia might, after all, turn out to be the most fortunate world in the system of Satania, the envied planet of all Nevadon. Anyway, I don't know.
Thanks for sharing that.
The hopes, the uncertainties, the realities.
Right.
You know, it's just all, it's all very real, maybe. I don't know, that doesn't really say much. But even Adam and Eve, they were.
We're going through them now, right? We're going through the same thing right now. The hope and the uncertainty and the, you know, the confusion and the, how's this going to turn out? How's this going to go?
Right.
But it will go fine.
You have to love Michael, though. Yeah.
Without a doubt.
For that message that he sent them.
Oh, man. Imagine if you were them, how that would feel. The weight of the world would have come off of their heart.
Among other expressions of friendship and comfort, he said.
Right. Yeah.
So
it's like your dad telling you, "It's okay, kid. Look, you know we all make mistakes, but I know that you meant well."
Right.
You know.
No,
it's
totally.
So fatherly. Yeah.
Very fatherly.
You gotta
very
love
fatherly.
It. Yes.
Yeah.
You gotta love it. He's a loving father, first and foremost. He is after his own father and our father. He shows
it's
us
not
the way
punishment.
To be like that. No.
Yeah.
It's about redemption, salvation.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, you see these great plot. You know, I was just thinking about this. You see these, we watch movies or we read books that have these plot lines that move from the past into the present, into the future. And they sort of tie things together in a grand way, in a way that has much more deep meaning than any passing moment can ever have. You see the relationship of events and whole historical trajectories unfolding, and you understand the depth of something in that plot line. And it's like, this situation is that on steroids. I mean, it's, you know, unfolding over hundreds of thousands of years and all of this struggle and pain and difficulty and confusion, you know, resulting in much greater good precipitating out. I mean, these are grand themes that are unfolding, you know, in the universe. Yeah, and it's actually quite a privilege to be part of it. You know,
isn't it so revealing as to why some of our best stories on this planet always involve that epic struggle, right?
Yeah,
the best stories, the most beloved stories, always illuminate that epic struggle. And the triumph, you know, we all want the triumph of good over evil.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, talk about picking yourself up and going on. I mean, look at what they had to do to create the second garden. I mean, the story of the second garden is just like over the top in terms of what you're talking about. In terms of a heroic, okay, we're not going to get discouraged. We're not going to give up. We're just going to pick up what
keep
we've
going.
Got and keep going. And the second
isn't that forever?
Hugely important, you know, with the Sethite priests and everything.
It's our
amazing
lesson.
Work.
We can do that.
Even,
they could do it.
Yeah.
We can do it. We can do it. We are. Uh-huh. We can rise like the phoenix out of the ashes. We can persevere. We can make this world better, and we will, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in that inherent in these stories, and it's why the stories are so important, is the lesson for us that we will triumph. Our progeny and our children and our children's children will succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's we can have hope and faith in that.
That's so important.
And look at all the
wisdom.
Help we've been given.
Yeah.
Well, you guys, I'd like to just quickly read Section 7 so we can get the Verandadec worlds out of the way, and then when we start up again in 2 weeks from now, friends, because we're all gone at the study next week, and then after that, several of us are gone the week after that. So we're going to take 2 weeks off, and we'll be back at the beginning of August. But that way we can start, when we start back up, we'll be on the Lananandek sons. And their world. So I'll just quickly read.
Go ahead.
It's just three paragraphs, and it's Section 7, the Verandadec worlds. The second group of seven worlds in the circuit of 70 primary spheres surrounding Salvington comprise the Verandadec planets. Each of these spheres, with its six encircling satellites, is devoted to a special phase of Verandadec activities. On these 49 realms, the ascending mortals secure the acme of their education respecting universe legislation. The ascending mortals have observed the legislative assemblies as they function on the headquarters worlds of the constellations. But here on these Verandadec worlds, they participate in the enactment of the actual general legislation of the local universe under the tutelage of the senior Verandadecs. Such enactments are designed to coordinate the varied pronouncements of the autonomous legislative assemblies of the 100 constellations. The instruction to be had in the Verandadec schools is unexcelled, even on Uversa. This training is progressive, extending from the first sphere with supplemental work on its six satellites, on up through the remaining six primary spheres and their associated satellite groups. The ascending pilgrims will be introduced to numerous new activities on these worlds of study and practical work. We are not forbidden to undertake the revelation of these new and undreamed of pursuits, but we despair of being able to portray these undertakings to the material mind of mortal beings. We are without words to convey the meanings of these supernal activities, and there are no analogous human engagements which might be utilized as illustrations of these new occupations of the ascending mortals as they pursue their studies on these 49 worlds and many other activities not a part of the ascendant regime are centered on these Veranda Deck worlds of the Salvington Circuit. So there's a preview of coming attractions, my friends.
Yeah.
Wow.
If
you're interested
cool.
in law, and I am, very much so, and how, you know, life on these unseen places, in these unseen, the world's unseen, will affect us and what we'll learn. That's a very intriguing section.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
To
study legislature.
Now, though we can hardly know how they're affecting us. It's almost as though we're swimming right now like fish in the sea in the legislative pronouncements of Edentia. You know, when they say law is life itself and not the mere rules of its conduct, I don't know how literally I want to take that. you know, it may in fact be that these laws really do function like universal laws, similar to gravity, not in the physical realm, but in terms of how they sculpt the parameters of our ability to decide, how they actually change the moral environment that we happen to be in. And I don't know how to describe it otherwise, but I can imagine that part of what they're doing is they're both liberating potentials and keeping other potentials under wraps at the same time for how we can actually grow in our universe, depending on you know, the state of affairs and what's actually wisest for a particular regime.
And we get to participate. That tells you something, too. That
yeah.
our experiences are invaluable to their process.
Yeah.
Well,
we maybe revisit
this when we come back, because there's so much that we could talk about here. I realize that. Yeah. Go ahead, Mark. Sorry.
In the second paragraph, there's an interesting, and we can look at this more later, but they say here on the Veranda Deck Worlds, they participate in the enactment of the actual general legislation of the local universe under the tutelage of the senior Veranda Decks. And then this interesting statement, such enactments are designed to coordinate the very pronouncements of the autonomous legislative assemblies of the 100 constellations. And what struck me is our efforts to coordinate the varied rights and legislations of our states with the federal legislation is a direct parallel to what they're describing here. And so they have to do that. They have to coordinate the varied and sometimes even at odds maybe pronouncements of some of the autonomous constellation legislations. They have to coordinate it at the local universe level, find a way to harmonize it, and that's, they're doing that all the way up there as well. So it's sort of an ongoing issue in some sense.
The struggle goes on, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a generic set of issues that's sort of structured into reality, a social reality.
Right.
You got to figure out how to do it well, you know?
Yeah, when you look at how very different areas are, you know, you can only imagine that different parts of the cosmos are varied and they have unique experiences. So you have to integrate and coordinate all of that. Amazing to think about.
Yeah.
Well, friends, we have that to look forward to. And that'll be great. And so we'll miss you all for the next 2 weeks, but we'll be back in a couple weeks with the continuing study of this paper, The Local Universe Sons of God. 3 weeks, right.
Yeah.
On Section 8, the Lanonandak Sons, and we'll do that one together. So thank you to our listeners, and thank you guys, Marvin, Andre, and Chuck. It's always a delight.
And Paul. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks for a great study. Another one.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Oh, and thanks for that correlation too, Andre. It was wonderful to read about the 12. I love that. I love that we took that diversion and read that. Mm. So that was great.
Yeah, that was helpful.
Cool.
Yeah. So thanks, friends. Till next time.
Okay. Have a great week.
See you in three weeks. You too.
See you in three weeks, everyone.
We'll see you there.
Bye for now.
See you in Chicago.
See some of you at summer study session.
Yep.
Yeah.
Bye for now.
All right.
Lots of love.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.